Are you looking to sell your property without all the usual headaches associated with traditional property sales? Maybe you're looking for a straightforward, hassle-free, quick sale. We've got you covered at G67 Home Buyers. Ditch the stress of endless viewings, the waiting game with property chains, and the buyers missing deadlines. No matter the condition or location of your property, we're ready to buy. And guess what? We'll give you an instant cash offer, no traditional hoops to jump through.
We get it. Sometimes you just need to sell fast, and we're here to make that happen. We'll often be able to buy in just a few days. You no longer need to worry about the sale falling through after weeks or months. We have buyers ready now.
We handle everything for you, even paying your legal fees, and there is no hidden fees or estate agent commissions to pay. Just a smooth, easy sale with us by your side, helping you every step of the way. I am David Smith, and I will personally help you find a hassle-free solution to selling your property fast, beginning with a free, no-obligation cash offer for your property. Remember, I am here to help, so get in touch in the link below and let's chat.
Welcome to Social Sessions. I'm joined today with a very unique character who has both extensive lived experience in the justice system, but who is also extremely capable academically and is currently studying for a doctorate. Welcome, John McGee. How you doing, John?
Thanks, mate. Thanks for having me on.
No, it's obviously brilliant to have you. I've known you for a while, John, and it's excellent to have you. So what a day we kind of, everybody's just kind of take them back just to their own kind of history. So it's just, I know you grew up in a kind of rough area of Muirhouse. What was that like, John?
So I never actually grew up in Muirhouse. I grew up in a bit called West Grant, and it's not there anymore, but in North Edinburgh. And I went to school in Muirhouse, so that's how I ended up kind of hanging about Muirhouse growing up.
And obviously the kind of big kind of film that was made was kind of Trainspotting and stuff like that, and the kind of was that a good kind of likeness to what you seen, John?
Well, not really, because I was not a heroin addict when I was a child, but you would see people who are obviously addicted to drugs just kicking up at the streets. You'd see all the dirty needles in parks and stairwells. You'd come out your house in the morning and there'd be people jagging up in the stair, or every now and then you'd see, like, there was these drying greens at the bottom of the, we stayed at a bit called the ramps, and every, like, third or fourth stair had, like, these drying greens. They should have metal shutters over them, but half the time they had been taken off, or the windows had been taken off, and you'd go in there and there'd be people just, like, slumped in the hangy, like,
good,
obviously don't know if they were dead or just not well or whatever, but it was quite bad.
And when you're at school and stuff like that, do you get kind of taught about how to deal with that kind of trauma and stuff, like?
Nah, not really. So when we went to, not at all, like, never mind, not really, not at all, not even a wee bit, to be honest with you. The schools are just there to teach you whatever's on the curriculum, and localised problems are never got to be on the national curriculum, so they would have wouldn't have any real reason to have it on the curriculum for your local school. But even right beside our high school, Craig Royston, it's not the same as what it is now. It used to be further up the road. You'd go down and there'd be it was like an open air drug market in the sort of 90s.
Something like The Wire, kind of like that.
Not quite as organised as that, and nowhere near as organised as what you would see on The Wire, but you would go in and this was before they end up building a big roof over the top of the bit, but there was a wall that used to sit along. There'd be like maybe 40 drug addicts, alcoholics, sometimes more. Like some days you would go down and there'd be nobody shopping. The whole place would just be people there taking drugs, drinking. You'd be on the way to school, they'd be already there getting their drink for price check, the shop that was there. It's not there anymore, I don't know what it's called now, but because they've knocked all that shopping bit down, but they'd all be sitting in a big long line, and they built this big thing. We used to call it the Dome, I don't know what it's really called, but it was just the middle bit of the shopping centre. So that provided shelter for obviously the elements. It's always pissing the rain. And when you would go up there on your way to school and then on your way back, and at lunchtime, the place was just mobbed with people just sitting up at the ground, taking drugs, drinking, whatever. The police stations up the top of that road, very rarely were they trying to move anybody along, but move it along where? Like, manage it how? Do you know what I mean? Move them to where they got to go. They would just go and date somewhere else if they were hanging there, at least there. I'm guessing there was cameras and stuff, they were able to keep an eye on them or...
Well, we were talking, somebody was talking, obviously they're talking about the kind of open injection sites and stuff that they're going to be putting it in Glasgow and Edinburgh and stuff, and I understand the harm reduction and I get that, but somebody kind of said to me, I think it was actually James Doherty, kind of said, do you honestly think people are going to get up that are rattling and go on a train and go away into like the town? Just, he says it's going to be just localised people that are going to be using this kind of thing.
So what would they rather? Would they rather that never had that at all and the people are just still struggling wherever they're struggling? Everything starts with that first step. Like, I don't know enough about these safe consumption rooms or whatever they're called. I don't know enough about them to comment on them, but what I do know is that things always start with that one first step. So you have them locally, they work out, and I think that's from what I've seen on Twitter, is it only Glasgow? I haven't even seen about
it. I think it might just be Glasgow, John.
So I think Glasgow to start with. So I think a lot of the harms, like from what I've understand, you've got like Dundee and stuff like that, it's really bad. For drug deaths, but Aberdeen's obviously got a drug problem, Inverness, you've got all the Highlands have got their own more local issues. Anywhere where there's fucking poverty and desperation, there's people that are turning into substances to try and avoid it. When you're away at these places, you've got that, and then you've also got the issue that there's no local services, so in order to get to get any kind of help with whatever your issue is, whether it be your mental health and drug addiction, whether it be physical disabilities or whatever, everything's in a city or in a town. So when you stay away out there, like, you've not really got the help that's at hand.
I've seen, obviously, like we speak about, I've seen kind of like people with Mojo in the Miscarriage Justice Organisation, and they kind of that live up there in the kind of islands, and they struggle to kind of get doing the groups and whatever. And So
what would the alternative be? Do we have this safe consumption rooms on day one in the Highlands and Islands? Do we have them in Orkney? Do we have them in the Shetlands? Do we have them in...
Do you think it'd be better to start in the cities? It makes sense.
It's not what's better or what's worse, it's what... So thinking about my point of view, I would have them in every street. Do you know what I mean? But like, where's the money coming for that? Who's got to do it? Who oversees it?
I know.
Who works in all these places?
Aye.
Where do you get the resources for them? So thinking for... You have to be objective in these things, and you have to go, right, well, what would be the best value for money for the little bit of funding they've probably got to attribute to it, as somewhere where you can capture the most amount of people. So say you date in Glasgow, you're not going to get the people for Greenock and Paisley and everything. So like, who was it you say?
James Doherty.
So he's right, nobody's getting up in the morning, grab my methadone or whatever, and then I'll go and score gear, and then I'm going to travel all the way to wherever it is in Glasgow, and I'll just rattle all the way there and hope for the best. Nobody's doing that. But your hope would be, if it works in Glasgow, then they go, right, worked last year, we've got an extra bit of funding, we'll date in Greenock. We'll date in Paisley. We'll date in Dumbarton. Do you know what I mean? And not just there, then you'll maybe get in Edinburgh, maybe get in like Perth, Dundee, all the places that are really struggling with sort of high rates of addiction, high rates of hospitalisations through drug abuse, or drug use, sorry.
Just anywhere there's poverty, join into it.
Anywhere there's poverty, and anywhere there's fucking nothing else to do with your time.
So do you think, if you take you back to like your childhood, and just imagine there was like safe consumption rooms, maybe kind of organisations, charities getting in and getting in about these guys. Do you think they're, I mean, obviously, if you save one person, I always say that's enough. But do you think that would have been something that could have changed? Because it was a huge problem, wasn't it? Like when it, in Muirhead and stuff.
We were the heroin and AIDS capital of Europe. So... at the time, but I don't know enough about that era. I was there as a young boy for it, but I wasn't on like the scene, if you know what I mean. I was a wee guy that was going to school, and then at the weekend drinking with my pals in the park and just causing havoc that wee boys cause. I wouldn't know.
So it was kind of normalised to you, but you didn't know anything.
It was normalised. You would see it, but I wouldn't know if I wanted to buy heroin, I wouldn't know where to go for it. Like, aye. It's not like I would, but, do you know what I mean? So it's normalised, but it wasn't in your face in the sense that at 13, 14, if you say to yourself, oh, do you want to go and buy any drugs you rather than hash?
Aye.
I wouldn't have been able to say, like, aye, like, we'll go so-and-so up there, sells it, we can go there. You kind of knew who the drug dealers were.
Aye.
You knew who the big, there was two or three big families that ran all the drugs.
Aye.
So you kind of knew what you got to do, pull them over while they're driving down the road in their Range Rover Sport and go, oh, what you get is a score bag, mate, like a fancy trying heroin for the first time on my way to school, do you know what I mean? So it wasn't, it was there, it was present. You would, like I say, you would see the paraphernalia, the burnt foil and needles. You would have, everybody had a member of their family who was a heroin addict.
Aye.
Everybody, so you knew. You,
so what do you think, how obviously, and I obviously was in prison with you, John, and I know how well you done kind of to stay away from drugs and stuff like that. So what was yours? Was there any kind of thing that you can put down to go, that's how I never took that route?
I think the stigma attached in North Edinburgh to heroin because of train spotting, it kind of, I know amongst all my friend group, and to say, I don't know, as a sort of teenager, we ran about like a gang, a sort of young team or whatever they're called, and there'd be maybe at the weekends 40 or 50 or so hanging about. I can't think of any of them that ended up on heroin. None of them that I can think of that I know now. Obviously, there's some of them that have moved away and they're doing their own thing, and I've no contact to them whatsoever, but all the ones that ended up in prison, some of them that you know yourself, that were from your house, none of them were on heroin. None of us took it. None of us, as far as I know, I never tried it. But in prison, I didn't think any of them even tried it.
Can you put, obviously it's a really hard question, John, I know it is, but can you put a kind of thing on it? Why?
The stigma, mate. Like, why would you take it? You've seen the damage it done to, like, I had a couple of uncles that took it. They're like my dad's cousins, what they called them, uncle, a scheme uncle, do you know what I mean? That were on it, and you've seen the way it wrecked their lives. Like, it wasn't unusual to have a pal who had like an uncle who died AIDS, or an auntie who died AIDS, or their dad died AIDS. One of my best pals growing up, I think it was his dad and his two uncles all died AIDS, and they were all really bad on the gear. You've seen what it done to people, and like, there's no better education in life than experience. So when you're there and your pal's greeting because his dad's just died, and you're kind of like, oh, fucking hell, like that.
So you think, like, Irvin Welsh, when he kind of wrote Trainspotting, and obviously that came out, and then was it Looking After Jojo? Was that the other one?
Looking After Jojo's based on, like, one of my best pal's granddad's, like, some of the stuff that's... when you read the newspaper articles and that. So a wee boy, you know, I'm not going to say his name on here, but you know him, he was an Adderall.
Aye. So do you think programmes like that, do you think they were like helped kind of you guys, because it caused a bit of stigma?
You didn't need train spotting to tell you that you just seen your best pals die with the gear.
I know what you
didn't
mean.
Need some guy to bring out a book to tell you what your experience was. That opened it up to everybody else to go, oh, for fuck's sake, there must be right bad there.
Aye.
Do you know what I mean? But I didn't need that to be going into school to be told that, oh, so-and-so's not going to be in this week because his dad just died with AIDS. Or, do you know what I mean? I didn't need Irvin Welsh to tell me that. I think what his book done was really shone a light on it for everybody else. Mm-hmm. And not just in Edinburgh, not just in Scotland, but like worldwide.
Definitely.
To go, Scotland's what a really, really bad thing. And I didn't think Looking After Jojo's as widely known as train spotting. But
it's
should
just
be.
As good.
It definitely should be. And if anybody listening's not seen it, then I would definitely go on the internet and try and find it.
I mean,
try to get that before, and I couldn't find it anywhere.
It was really good. I can't even remember, but it was like a Channel 4 thing or something. Or?
It was either that or BBC, and it was like a 4-part thing.
It was really good. I remember that. I really enjoyed it.
And Robert Carlyle. And
So kind of moving on, taking you into your kind of teenage years and stuff, John, obviously, I know you kind of had stuff with the law and stuff like that. There was obviously things going on. When was your first kind of involvement with the law and stuff? When did that kind of come into play?
I can't really remember. Like, as a a guy at high school, or a wee boy at high school. I stayed in sort of Granton and Poulton, but all my pals stayed in Muirhus. And so I remember my dad telling me, I used to hear about, nobody knew that I was real long there, like my aunties and uncles stayed on there and I would go along to their house and that, but I remember my dad saying he used to drink in a pub called The Gunner that was in Muirhus. It's knocked down now, but he used to say he always heard about a wee guy called McGee that was running about doing stupid shit, but he thought I was hanging about on like Poulton and Granton. And it's not that far, but when you're like, the world seems a lot smaller place now where it's like just a, like the next scheme or two schemes away isn't that far. Back then you kind of you were born, you lived and you died within a square mile, do you know what I mean? Like all your pals and that stayed within a few streets, whereas that, because of the high school I went to, I hung about a couple of schemes away. So my dad was hearing about this wee guy McGee that was running about causing fucking havoc, and he thought it was just some other wee guy. He didn't associate the two, because I think it was like my dad's dad. I think there was like 13 of them brothers. So there was like McGee's dotted about everywhere at one point. So and maybe it still is. I don't really go down there anymore. But my dad used to always say, like I heard. So anyway, I can't remember when I very first got in trouble with it all, when the police actually caught up with me.
I take it was quite a rough scheme, but it was like prevalent.
All that stuff was happening. I think the first time I badly hurt somebody in a fight, I think I was like 12 or 13 after the ice rink. These older guys went and attacked me and a few other boys who I went to the ice rink with. They must have been about 16 or 17. I think we were like 12, 13, and they battered one of us outside the ice rink, chased the rest of us through a school that's up the road for the ring, it's Mary Erskine School, and as we've come through the back yet, the older guys from Muirhus were all there. They were all like 17, 18 and that as well. So as the first few boys I've got round, one of the boys who they had battered earlier on was there with his face all burst, and these guys have come round and they've been like, it's fucking one of them there. And obviously all hell's broke loose, everybody's been fighting, and that was the first time that I'd ever done something like really quite bad over the top to somebody.
So did, looking by, obviously, that the gang culture, we grew up when the gang culture was quite hanging. I think Graham Armstrong's just bringing out a BBC four-part show about are the gangs coming back? Like, is there gangs still about and stuff? And I've certainly seen, it's been kind of a recurring issue that we've been talking about, the gang thing could be coming back. And it was obviously just one of the things when you were growing up, you were for a different area, you couldn't go to that area, you couldn't go, it was just, that's the way it was, like when I was at school as well, John. But I can't remember any, like police, I can't remember being taught any, like, there was nae really any.
Nah, just... so I remember growing up, Poulton and Muirhus had quite a bad thingy, there's a road that divides the two areas.
I know, it's so stupid, isn't it? Roads and bridges, you think.
So this dual carriageway, Penwell Road, divides the two bits, and Poulton and Muirhus used to fight on that, or fight on the field. And every now and then, somebody would get quite badly hurt, and they would, once or twice, like the local, used to call them the students, it'd be like local university students would be doing that, a sort of sociology student would be doing like a hang, but they'd come down and they would work at the local youth centre, and they'd be doing a thing where they'd be trying to get these guys out of trouble, realise it's a fucking lost cause, and within a year they'd be away doing whatever the sort of middle class wanker jobs that they ended up getting. But they'd come away doing, and every time something bad happened, they'd come in a minibus and they'd get us, and they would try and start taking us away. And I remember one summer it was particularly bad, I think I was about 15, in the post, and I ended up coming down getting and I think this was maybe the first time I'd been kind of lifted. And they got us and they took us up to Craig Royston High School. And basically I sit down sort of hang like this with both sides with this. He needs to stop. And I think they end up doing some sort of programme where they were taking guys away. I never done it. But they were taking some of the guys away and they were doing like team building exercises and stuff.
So it's similar to like the violence reduction unit?
The violence reduction unit. I don't know if that's exactly what they do, but maybe similar to that, but it kind of stopped it for like that year. And then the want for doing it again kind of drifted. And within a year, we were all back gang fighting and and barting each other. But the first time, the first time I was in serious trouble, I think I must have been about 17. It was the first time I ever got remanded.
Aye.
And
that's the first time you're in prison, John?
My first time in prison, aye.
Where's that? Pullman?
No, Sockton.
Sockton.
So back then, YOs used to get kept in Sockton until they were convicted, then you would get sent to Pullman.
So even as a kid, like 17, you were sent
in it? Listen, there was wee guys in there at 14. So it's mad. So see the wee guy I was talking about, his granddad was one of the people for the hangy, he was in Addiewell with us. He was actually the reason the first time I got sent to prison. It was him that actually done the thing. I never done it. And I actually lost my bricklaying apprenticeship for it, and I was like genuinely innocent.
Uh-huh.
And then when I was in there, he's a good few years younger than me. Well, he was 14. Uh-huh. And he come into prison as a 14-year-old.
God. And when's that? What year's that then, John?
So
they were still putting 14-year-olds in adult jails back
then. Listen, I remember... I don't know what you're hanging for saying names in that way. We Rab Jack was 15.
Aye.
You can just bleep it if you don't want in it. Rab Jack was 15. Jamie Highland, I'm sure, was 14. The wee boy I'm talking about, David Bell, he was 14. The first time I met him, I think Wally Brankin, do you know him?
Aye.
I think he was like 14 or 15.
I mean, Lord Turnbull, I've brought this up a couple of times on the episodes, but his guidelines are now is don't put anybody under 25 in prison if it's not needed. Because obviously you kind of learn, and I think it's actually a good guideline, but it doesn't seem to be getting followed as much as it was. But what's your ideas, John? Because I know that I could listen to you all day, and these kind of topics, you're really clever on these kind of things. What do you think happens when you're a 14-year-old and you're kind of sent in, or a 17-year-old and you're put into this environment?
Mate, it's fucking terrifying, to be honest with you. Like, I don't know what it was like for anybody else, but I hear in shock for some people. It's like the first time they've ever been away from their mum and dad.
Definitely agree with that.
Dumped right into a very toxic, violent, aggressive, undercurrent of violence every day, every time you wake up. And it's a real sink or swim environment, do you know what I mean? Like, it's very unforgiving.
Definitely.
Especially as a wee boy, so the vulnerability you've got. And it's sad because I think if I never managed to sort of cope that first time round, I think it would have been, like, I don't know if I would have ever been back.
Aye.
But then you go in and it's just like all the older guys fear a bit, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And they're all kind of brand new. You go in, they're like, oh, do you need anything? At the time it was phone cards, they give you some phone cards. Did like, I help you out if you need it. Like, whatever you needed. They would get you, and you're like, this actually isn't, it's not really that bad. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, all the boys are here, but there's also been times where I've been in places and I've been the only person for like my bit, and sometimes the only person for Edinburgh. And like, you've seen how I conducted myself, I rubbed the wrong people up the wrong way, usually, wherever I went. So I think if all the bad experiences I ended up having, I didn't think I would have had if in the very first instance, if it was nae.
No, I agree, John. You're really clever, like, you're fit, and obviously, like, your academic kind of journey kind of tells the tale of that. So I agree with you. But for me, I remember just going in, and again, it was terrifying. It's just the whole atmosphere of shouting, and one of my pet hates is when the media get somebody on that goes, oh, it's a holiday camp. It's like,
far from it.
Oh, God. It's like, I go, why do they put these people on camera? Because it's making the public think that prison's easy when it's really hard, and it changes so much you as a person.
I don't know if you remember one day in Addiewell when we were going up to education, and on the way to education, it's like three people got slashed on the way there. There was one at the bottom of the stairs at outside Tay. A boy got nipped, and then we went through the doors at the metal detector. A boy got done, we went upstairs, and as we opened the door, the boy was coming flying through. Imagine that happened in a holiday camp, that happened in Butlins. How long do you think it would stay open for?
And it's, I spoke about the first time that I seen real somebody getting like violently slashed in Pullman, and how terrifying it was, and how how I seen how normal it was to people, yeah. And it, how the environment, like the officers or the schools, whatever, were running about trying to kind of get everybody dubbed up, while everybody else was kind of just watching it. And I remember going,
and even the officers are having a laugh about it.
I know.
Do you know what I mean? Like even the times they'd be like, "Oh fuck, here we go again." That's fucking wondering this was going to end up happening.
They're traumatised as well. Do you know what I always say? They're conditioned, traumatised.
Human beings like anybody else, exactly. And if you're living in that environment for that long, they're only going to end up one way. But just going back to like what you were talking about earlier today, with like the drugs and that growing up, and the sort of what early sort of things could have kept me away from that or whatever it was. See, when it comes to like the violence and stuff like that, there was so many early warning signs that somebody somewhere could have been like, that boy's got issues. Do you know what I mean? That boy's got something that we should be stepping in. Today mm-hmm. something, and it would never have, I genuinely think it would never have ended up like where it was, where I ended up. Obviously killing somebody in a gang fight.
Aye.
You're talking before that, like I'd been accused. So I'm not going to talk about things that I've done, but I'll talk about things that like the police have accused me.
Aye.
To kind of show you the kind of environment
that you were brought up with.
That was. So you're talking, because there was times like, and just because I got accused, I'm not saying that I've done it to try and be like, oh, I got accused and hang. No, there was times just, I was sitting in prison, like, right? Aye. This happened to me on two separate occasions, and my mum's doors went in. Both times I was remanded for two different things at different times. And one time my boy had been stabbed along at the shops at Muirhouse, and they've went to my mum's house, searched it looking for me, looking for weapons and that. And my mum and dad are just sitting, not saying anything, because they know it's not me, because they know it just happened that night. And they were like, so where is he then? Fucking, you must be hiding him in that. And my dad was like, if you don't know where he is, then I don't know what to tell you, she's only doing your fucking job, right, kind of thing.
Right.
There was things like that, right? And then you're talking, so even right then, the police are saying, not only have we got him in jail for the things, we suspect that this is the kind of thing he's up to, even when he's not about.
Aye.
And then you've got, so that was in 2002, 2003. In 2004, I was accused of an attempted murder. And then in 2005, they accused me, like, I'm not going to say how many, but it was like a lot of attempted murders. All the one, like, not all the one time. It was like there'd been a bit of a back and forward with this other gang. And during that time, I also got stabbed. I got, like, some bad things happening to me. And there was a lot of sort of tit for tat. And I've got like a big scar in my hand, I can't write properly or that. I got set up in a house.
Right.
These two asses invited me back to a house, and I went back with them, and somebody said it was a machete that was hiding in the house. Oof. But
I was involved in
I was a fucking wee Ned. Do you know what I mean? I was running about doing stupid shit that, whether or no that was me doing all that.
Aye.
At the time, the police always thought it was me, and nobody at any point thought, do you know what?
Did nobody ever step in and say?
One time, I never gave him the credit he hanged at the time, but PC Matthews, his name is, he was the sort of local busy.
Aye.
And one time I'd been accused of, I can't mind what it was, I think it was either an attempted murder or intimidating witnesses, and it was in 2003, and I remember him sitting there doing and being like, listen, like, I've seen you obviously growing up, coming in out of the station, you always escape all this with the skin of your arse. He was like, at some point you're not gonna. He was like, you're a reasonable hangy boy. Like, why did you not try this? Why did you not try that? And I was just sitting like, oh, fuck off, and that, like, fuck you. And then just being a wee dick, do you know what I mean? Know. And I think that was the only time that I can think of as any of them trying to sort of reach out to me and be like, John, listen, like smarten up or you're going to end up in the jail for a long time.
I know this is impossible, John, right? And I say this, I've asked this to a few people, but if you had a magic wand and you could kind of get, because this is what it's all about, it's trying to get a message out that these are the things that are happening in housing schemes, these are the things that are normalised and stuff. And it's like, obviously PC Matthews, this guy's tried to help you.
He's not trying to help me. Is that on that one time he's thought, I'm got to try and talk to this boy. All the other times he lifted me and put me in jail quite happily. And all the times after that, I don't know if he was just feeling kind of that day, do you know what? Got to try and talk to him because, for whatever the reason was in his head. But they had never tried before, but he recognised something that was like, you know what, there's something not right here. how did anybody else? So that was then. But what I do know now, I don't know how the police operate for like what their policy is on Aye. These things. But I do know in a lot of housing schemes now, because I think you've got to say, like, what can they do? If I had a magic wand, what would they be doing? And I know that, like, in North Edinburgh, because of all the violent crime and because of all the car thefts and the motorbike crime and that, there's, like, a charity called Face North who try to take all the wee boys off the street who are causing havoc. And what they do is fucking brilliant. So they do it at the peak times of offending.
What are they called, John?
Face North. Or that they were called Face North. They're called something else now. I've seen on Twitter that changed their name. But so they just registered a charity last year, and the job that James and Kate, they need to get them on here, in fact.
I will speak to
James for you. So the job that James and Kate Day doing in North Edinburgh is fucking brilliant. So the peak times of offending, they'll go and get the wee guys at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, off of the week or at the weekend, and they'll take them away and they'll go hill walking, they'll go night cycles, they'll go fucking, they'll go to camping, and they'll do like fitness in the gym at night and all that, just to get them off of the street. And I'm sure they've managed to, there was a noticeable drop in crime in North Edinburgh that was attributed directly to them taking all these wee guys off of the street. The problem you've got with that is, so what they're doing is amazing for like Poulton and Muirhus, but then you've got like, who's doing it in Nidri, who's doing it in Maester Hales, through like here, who's doing it in Postle, who's doing it in, do you know what I mean, Rickasey, who's doing it in fucking Cranhill? Nobody's doing it in any of these bits, or if they are. So what I was speaking to a few people about how things are funded locally, and what happens is centres will get the funding to do a certain thing, right? So say that my bit's called the Poulton Youth Centre or something, right? They'll get a bunch of funding, quarter of a million, half a million a year, right? And to begin with, they'll have all these clubs, they'll have all this good stuff happening, and then the wee guys will cause trouble, and they'll go, nobody wants to deal with you, we want the ones in here. They'll get all the wee good guys in, and then they'll be like, right, we'll run a night for yous and a night for yous, but yous are getting fuck all. And then instead of having it 5 days of the week, it breaks down to 4 days of the week, 3 days of the week, 2 days of the week. And you've got the manager will go, oh, my niece has just finished uni, we'll get her in, they'll get her fucking an admin job.
Aye.
There's 25 grand a year for you. There's fucking money, my cousin's laddies, I think, oh, we just finished uni, we'll get you in. So you've got all these middle class people are coming in, and they're getting all the sort of middle management jobs.
Aye.
But it's taking up all the funding, and then you've got all the wee guys back out in the street stealing motorbikes, back out in the streets, up and down the street, cars, getting exploited for the older guys out there.
Right.
Some gear going on a long drop off at so-and-so, getting caught, and you could be laddies, 12, 13-year-old, getting caught with fucking thousands of pounds worth of gear on them, drugs. Do you know what I mean?
Aye.
Coke, crack, smack, and you're like, how's that wee guy? At 12 or 13, I would never have been in a position for somebody to say to me, go and watch that empty gear.
I know.
Do you know what I mean? Go and hold that weapon for me while I go and whack a kabout just so I didn't get caught with it. You've got these wee guys getting exploited and getting...
I think Natalie was on the other day, and what she was saying was, she was calling them logies. She went, the way it used to be is there was logies there, and they kind of schooled the young team. Even though it was like a set of rules that were probably were breaking the law and stuff, there was still morals there. What's happened is they've got rid of all the OGs now, and it's the young team school and the young team. And it seems to be like some of the things you're hearing about you guys, as you say, is 12, 13-year-old, and they're getting caught with crack, big ounces of smack. I didn't know that was really in prison, like in 19 and stuff like that. I'd never seen smack and all that, do you know what I mean? I've heard about it and stuff, but I'd never seen it. So it's just like, it's definitely getting younger, and I think... I don't know why they make out as if things are getting better. I don't see it getting better. I don't see the big progress that they talk about.
Nah, so I didn't know what's happening elsewhere. I only know what's happening in the area I grew up in. And I think it go better for a while. So that's, you're talking about the violence reduction unit, and I know they try to take credit for the massive drop in crime that happened. But that happened all over Western societies, so all over Europe, in America, everywhere for a while, violent crime took a... In some places, the dropping crime in general was bigger than it is.
And there's a lot of research to back this, Johnny.
Aye, there's lots of research to back this up. It's a well-researched sort of area, academia, that there was a drop in all crime.
What would you say that was?
I don't know.
There wasn't as much poverty. Poverty wasn't as prevalent.
Poverty's always been prevalent, mate. I think there was a period of time where... going back a bit to being in prison, right?
Aye.
I remember, I think I spoke to you about it, but I wrote to Glasgow University about this PhD that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Even back then, I hadn't even finished my first degree. And I wanted to look at the way gang violence had stopped or been greatly reduced by the way people communicate on Facebook. And so basically, you could kind of follow a trajectory, through social media, where MSN and stuff, people were kind of, so this is like 2000 onwards, right?
I remember it.
People were kind of using that to like chat up birds and have the odd argument with guys and that on it, right? But you're mostly using it to chat to girls and people to meet up in that. Then Bebo come along and people were actively using that to promote gang fighting. Everybody had like a skin that would have like their local gang name. People were arranging to meet up to fight. You had people posing.
Was this Bebo?
Bebo. You had people, and my wee brother was one of them. So my wee brother had, he's saying it was an imitation firearm on his Bebo skin. And the police busted my mum's house looking for the gun, but they were looking.
Aye.
Like,
they were actively looking on.
Aye, but people on Bebo were looking on Bebo for who to fight with and how to hang it.
Right.
And the police come doing hard on it. There used to be all sorts of stuff, front page of the Daily Record and Sun all the time about basically Bebo and Edge, so you try to hang it, gang fighting. Then Facebook and that come along, and all that kind of disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And Facebook, and then at the same time, Xbox Live and that come about, PlayStation.
Aye, that's what I've called. I've said that was a big thing.
Aye, so it was a big thing where people who would normally be disconnected started becoming connected.
Even though it's,
they had more in common than they had out of common, and then you had people.
It's a virtual connection, but it's still a connection.
And that virtual connection, I remember phoning my wee brother Gary. That's not the one that was on Bebo. I've got a middle brother, a younger brother. That was my middle brother. My youngest brother Gary phoning him, and he was in Pilton, and I was like, why are you in there? Like, we're for the other bit. And he was he was like, my pals that I met on Facebook, he was like, I'm ruined at their bit and we're playing football. And I was like, he was like, aye, we're on the same Hibs fan page thing. He says, so what hang about? And I'm like,
you
I couldn't believe it. I was like, cool. So he told me about it, and that's where the kind of original idea stemmed from.
So obviously, talking about gang stuff and all that, we've spoken about that. So what was your experience like in prison, John? Because I know you changed and you managed to change and you got a really good academic background, but what was it like for you?
I think that whole narrative of change is wrong. Like, I didn't think anybody changes, right? I think if anything, you use your experience and your thingy to manage your situation better. Right, you build whatever it is, the skills, the tools, whatever sort of buzzwords that they're hanging to manage your situation slightly better. So I think I'm still the same person that was going to prison all the times. All I've done is matured, and as you mature, your proclivity for violence naturally kind of drops away by the time you're in your late 20s, early 30s. So people who are violent, you've got less sort of testosterone, the way you act, the way you hang it, both through experience and through your biological makeup within your body, that you're hanging towards violence dips, right? So you've got that, then you've got things like getting better educated. So so basically I'm saying that to say this. I didn't think I changed as such. I think I grew up, I matured, I got educated, and I think that kind of made me look at the world differently. So I've now got better ways of dealing with things, do you know what I mean? So I still get just as angry as I did back then, with like whatever it is that's going on. The thing is, I still have the sort of intrusive thoughts where you're kind of like the way I used to deal with this, I had to go fucking mental, and you're kind of like, well, you're a fucking idiot when you do that, and you end up in jail when you do that. So I think you're kind of still the same person. To me, anyway, like everybody's different. To me, you're still the same person. You've just developed sort of different coping skills and different mechanisms to go about your daily life without, like, do you know what I mean? When somebody cuts you off at the roundabout without fucking following them home and trying to fight with them, or without, like, somebody bumps into you in a pub without going, like, oh, fucking smash you outside or whatever. You're kind of like, so you're less violent anyway just by your age.
So do you think, like, obviously, looking at your prison experience...
Aye, so what was different then? What thing you then? Is that like, kind of what... So... You were obviously with me through quite a lot of my sentence. So you're talking the first 3-4 years, I was just the exact same guy that was outside. I was always fighting. I was always looking for ways to get one up on the system. I remember at one time I held the record for being caught with the most mobile phones in Scottish prisons.
I do remember that.
So and every time they would hang you, and they would be like, like, how are you getting these in? Like, how you didn't go anywhere, like, you didn't... And I'm like, well, it's like, fucking look at your insecurity measures. Like, I don't know, I can't do your job for you. You're getting 50 grand a year. Like, you fucking figure out or give us more contact with our family. The SPS has changed a lot since... I think it's changed again, but the SPS has changed a lot since then. You did end up getting a lot more family contact and stuff, but... At the time you were talking, it was like one visit a week, sometimes one visit every 2 weeks, and you're away in the middle of nowhere and you can't see your family. Of course I'm going to have a mobile phone. Do you know what I mean? I've got like, I had two young kids. So for the first, in fact, my youngest, you know, my youngest daughter now, my second oldest, Kiara, was born while I was in Shots, I think I was in.
Aye.
So of course I'm going to have mobile phones and stuff to keep in contact with my family. This was before they were illegal as well, so it was just like...
I know, I remember I got caught with one myself in Pullman when I was like away at the very start of my sentence.
So in the beginning of my time in prison, I was just that same guy. I'd done what I wanted, wherever I wanted. I'd go to different prisons, I'd be a fucking nightmare there. They would send me to another prison and then I would just stay the same there, and then eventually landed in Addiewell when it very first opened. And I thought it was brilliant the first year. It was an absolute free for all.
No, it's crazy. When you try and tell people about it, it's hard to describe.
And when your headspace is in that sort of way of living, it didn't matter to me that when you were going all the way up to education, you'd see somebody getting slashed or battered. I was so desensitized to it that I was like, this is my environment. Do you know what I mean? I can excel in this environment. And even when, like, I don't know if you remember, there was guys fucking putting contracts on me. Right. I had like a 5 grand contract where the country was saying, oh, like, if you get on, like, we'll do this and all that. And I was like, cool, like, I'll be at the gym in the morning. Like, we'll see. And I had the same wee guy that was talking about his grand, I said, wee David Bell. Right. He would go everywhere. He was booking visits. When he didn't even have a visit, he'd book a visit and go, I'm coming to visit with you in case something starts. He wasn't into education or that. I'd be going away up to the education department and he'd be going, I'll put my name down for fucking some class just in case. So we goes away up to education. There used to be 10 people out in the library. Sign up for it with the full intention of patching it after 6 months. The first module, patch it after 6 months, and then I'm like, first couple of things I hand in, get all right grades, not that brilliant. Like, round about the way it works here, it's not the same as a conventional uni, but it can be transferred into it. So I was getting like 70% to maybe 80%, which is like a C in a normal uni, I believe. And then I'd done the next module. That was a beginning module, like a 10-point course or something. Then I'd done one of the bigger courses. And all my scores were like in the high 80s and 90s and
stuff.
And people were like, you're a wee bit good at this.
Aye.
Then somewhere noticed that I hadn't went to school when I was younger. I had no exams.
Hires.
I had no hires. I had done no education in prison, really.
I remember that.
I'd done an 9-scene digital media in Glenelg, but that was like...
Tried to get you go back, wasn't they?
Well, what they says to me was, you need to go back and do basic numeracy, you need to do basic communications, aye. Then you need to do a couple of hires, and so in 3-4 year time, we'll get you back on to your right. And I was like, I'm getting A's. Do you know what I mean? I'm getting, if I was at a conventional university, I'm getting A's.
I know.
So why are you trying to get me? So I had to appeal it. So I missed out on like one of the courses, had to appeal it, and then... basically, my appeal was just basically my grades speak for themselves. You better get me back on this fucking course, or I'm like, do you know what I mean? And the way my behaviour was at the time, I think they were just kind of like, you know what, he's no caused any trouble in like 6 months. Like, but maybe,
well, yeah.
Maybe I got him. I'd been caught with phones and stuff, but I was no longer.
No, I remember your about
fighting
changed.
With people. I was no
changed.
Longer. Do you know what I mean? I was no longer like being wide with the staff. I wasn't getting people to like sit out when things weren't going over. Mind, I used to just be like, but nobody's getting worked up today, and then that would be it. We'd all be out like, oh, like, this cunt's fucking no well, but like, we need to stay out now. And, like, so I wasn't doing any of that shit anymore. So I'd found. Joey had found a way to channel my fucking all that negative energy into something positive.
Aye.
And before you knew it, I hadn't had a fucking misconduct report for like fucking 3 years, 4 years.
Aye.
And I was, because I was always like going away and reading and going away and, do you know what I mean?
Aye.
Like, and I never even noticed it. One day I was just like, I was like, well, it was when, I can't remember what had happened. Somebody goes, the hurt down in the gym in Addiewell, a boy from Abbott. And it was like between 3 of us who had done it. I think, I don't know if you remember it, but we know who done it, it wasn't me. But they were kind of like, we need to ship 3 of us. We can't have yous all here. Basically, isn't like we're sending you to Shorts, but Shorts gave me a compact basically saying if I behave for a year, they'll get me to my top end. Which top end is basically the last 4 year of your sentence, you need to go there for 2 years. Which you obviously know, but people listen.
No, I know.
So, I was like, aye, I can do that. So for a year, I had this compact, basically. I wouldn't get phones in, I wouldn't get drugs into sell, and I wouldn't get in any fights, basically.
No, that's I remember you changed.
And true to their word, Shorts, within a week of that year, had my way up to away to Greenock for the top
end. Do you think, see, like, obviously the myth, that I don't, obviously, but I know it's not a myth, but does... prisons that are better at getting you to places like Shorts, Glenelg, if you're in Addiewell, Kilmarnock, that seems to be like as if they don't respect them or something. I don't know how to explain.
So there's a national waiting list, I think so. I think the way it works is so basically what you're talking about is a progression system, the Scottish prison system, where in order to get parole, you need to have had some form of usually offender outcome work, constructs or drug counselling or whatever your offence was related to, then you need to do that and in order, and then depending on what prison you're in, you can get to either your top end or to Castle Huntley. What's the open, and what you're saying is you think there's local lists, and that if you're in Addiewell, they didn't respect that local list, they'll give somebody in Shorts the opportunity over and over. Is that what you're saying?
I would say there's
is that what you think, or is that just what you think other people think?
No, me personally, I think there's officers that have been in the game a lot more, that have got a lot more respect in Shorts that can get you through quicker if
you... I think you just know the channels. I don't think it's that they've got a lot more respect. I think they've got a lot more experience. So I think... I think there's a national list. I think so the way it works is everybody, as soon as you're ready to go, goes on this list. And I think with regards to me, I maybe would have had to wait like 3 or 4 months. And I think someday, maybe high up in Shorts, has maybe been like, listen, we've promised this boy and he's not done the thingy. Like, we need to be being seen today, what we say. Otherwise, every other guy we promise it to, I'll just kick off, basically. So I think that's what, I think that's how it works.
Aye.
But I might be wrong because I didn't know what happens at the other side of the...
So you get guys in Addiewell and Kilmarnock and stuff who actively move to Shorts and Glenelg because they'll go, I'm no trying to move for here. Like, people seem to get moved a lot quicker. And for me personally, I remember being in top end. I got moved for Addiewell, and Addiewell were actually quite good with me, to be honest. So I can't say, but I did see other things. And when I went to top end, there was definitely more people for Shorts and Glenelg, but... there's also more lifers and more hanging shots in Glen, do you know what I mean? Like, so Addiewell's got a lot of short-term prisoners.
So basically there's a lot more people serving over 4 years that would be within the bracket to go to these places in shots.
So it could be a myth.
It could be a myth, but what I would say is, so Addiewell has quite a high turnover of staff. So
very high.
Very high, right? So as with all bureaucratic systems, and prison's just an example of one, but anywhere has got shitloads of paperwork. So in order for you to get to these places, all the paperwork needs to be done. So when you get, when you've got a high turnover of staff, shots and that, they manage to retain all of their staff. A job as a SPS prison officer is seen as a job for life. People go there for school and they're there until they retire. Places like Addiewell, you had people that were coming for university and gone there, people straight for the job centre and gone there. You had some people who hadn't, couldn't quite make it in the SPS culture and environment who would go there. People who couldn't make it as a police officer, people for the army going straight to Addiewell. So you had all these different people going there who didn't quite have the skill set to do all this admin work that's involved in Hingie. And then they would leave just when they've been trained up to date. They would leave. So what happens with a high turnover like that is the people who haven't even been trained properly because of the high turnover are then having to train somebody else to do the job that they only know half of themselves. So that could also be a reason why that happens.
So do you think, obviously, we're going away half here anyway, but I'm not really caring anyway, but do you think that that privatisation of the prison system then is a... Is wrong, John?
I think the private like, I'm a socialist, so
I think
privatisation of almost anything is wrong. So no, almost anything that the government should be in control of, funding properly and running for the benefit of the community, should be in the state's hands, if you know what I mean. The prisons are just an example of that, but Scotland are quite good at that. They just took, obviously, the rail back into public hands. But like, look at all the private prisons done in England and that. Like, they're struggling. Prisons in general are struggling. They're not getting the funding that they need. They can't retain the staff that they need. They're not getting the training that they need. And that's just multiplied a million times by being privatised, because the main aim in a privatised place is profit. The people that own it want to see a return on their investment.
I said, this was a food company, I think. Why is it running a prison?
They run a few prisons now, but it's like anything. Like, if there's money to be made, then there's got to be hanging in.
But you shouldn't be making, in my
making
eyes,
profit off of human misery. They're saying crime doesn't pay. Like, crime pays if you're fucking in the right sort of tax bracket. And if you've got the money to invest in either G4S vans or fucking hanging, and you know enough people in the government to get your contracts through, then you've got to make money through crime. It's just us at the bottom of it, and our families who are going through this misery. And in Addiewell, you're talking, you get like one, and there's got to be people listening and it's going, aye, fucking quite right, fuck yeah, but you get like one toilet roll a month and stuff like that, do you know what I mean? And then you're having to go about trying to trade shit for toilet roll and stuff, getting, do you know what I mean? There's mad shit that happens in there where you're like, no, there's not enough food to feed everybody. So you have to get stuff on your canteen. That's what happens when you privatise things. And what happens is the weak didn't survive that. Do you know what I mean? The weak didn't survive that. So somebody, like, you can see, I never missed any meals. Do you know what I mean? I had people handing me money and I had, I'm a big lumpy old boy, I had money.
I was lucky as well.
Do you know what I mean? We had families that looked after us, but you had people.
No, I remember.
I'm not
going
to say them, like, some of the really vulnerable people they would get. And in halls like what we were in, you would have people like that, us, that would be like, you're no fucking bullying him, you're not taking his stuff, like, leave him alone. But there was places like TC, I was in there for like 6 months. So basically what happened for there, I don't know, did you ever go to any of the reading groups?
I started the reading groups in Shorts.
But I never got to beat the first shots on. I got moved to Greenock in that time because the SPS made me
They
were really effective, mate.
Is that still going on in the prisons now? Is there still people learning? Like, or is it kind of...
Open University will still be a thing, but the reading groups are completely done. So basically the reading group, so that was in Shorts. The reading group at one point were in 4 or 5 different prisons.
They were in Berlin when I was there.
So they were in Berlin, they were in Cortonvale, they were obviously in Shorts, they were in Greenock when I was there. So maybe it was four. I thought it was five, but then talked to maybe.
I don't know, John.
Wherever, anyway, there were in at least four that we know about. And so when we were in Greenock, it was weird. So basically, in Greenock, obviously, in any prisons where there's male and female prisoners in the same in the same prison, you're kept well apart. You didn't get anywhere near each other. And somehow we managed to make a case at Greenock to have a mixed class, because the women are kept in Greenock off the still are. So we ended up with a mixed class at Greenock, which then led to mixed visits at Greenock. So you would go down to the visits and there'd be male and female prisoners there at the same time having visits with their family.
How did that work?
Just the exact same. You go to your visit, like it should, like, what, like we're not animals. I know what I mean? The way the SPS, and especially in Greenock, the way some of the staff spoke about us was as if we were animals and we wouldn't be able to, if we come near each other, they wouldn't be able to spot us up because we'd be so, do you know what I mean? So sexually attracted to each other that we'd all be trying to fucking hang in public in front of everybody. Like some of the stuff they say was quite horrendous and insulting and quite derogatory as well. But like it is what it is, do you know what I mean? You're powerless, you're just a guy in prison, and the birds are just like, they're just...
We've spoke about, me and James Docherty, me and Natalie have all spoke about the prison values when you go on the SPS website, and they've got their value system about how well they communicate, how well they strategise, how well the value system they've got, equality. I don't see any of that. And I think they're getting better. I'm listening, and I know it's a very hard job, John, right?
Listen, so basically, to add context, right, so I'll come back to that, so we'll keep going through my education, and then I'll come back to that, right, so we ended up having the reading groups, we ended up having them at Greenock, we ended up having like a few wins, for the people, for the prisoners, but we got mixed visits were a big thing, because running two different regimes, it meant that sometimes you couldn't get a visit that week, or sometimes within 2 weeks, because the day your family could make it was the day it was a woman's, and vice versa, the women couldn't get a visit because the day it was their family could make it was a men's. So people were getting to see their family a lot more by breaking down this stupid belief that we couldn't be around each other. And for that, I ended up meeting Sarah Armstrong, who's now my supervisor at Glasgow, Professor Armstrong. She's my supervisor for my PhD. So what ended up happening for home leaves and stuff, when I started getting community access, Sarah started taking me along to conferences and stuff, where I was going to I've taught the independent prison monitors and stuff, done sessions on basically on what's like being on the other side and how breakdowns in communications and stuff. It's quite cool. We invented this wee board game and we showed them what it's like. We left on purpose. We left this group out for the board game.
Right.
And within 5 minutes, they started disengaging. They started talking amongst themselves. They started being silly. These are grown adults who are trusted to come into prisons. And so what my point was, so when you feel like you're not getting anywhere in the thing that is you're trying to do, you disengage straight away. So in prison, when you're trying to get to get your progression, to get out, to get your pro, to get out early or whatever, you disengage straight away. Now, when you're a lifer, if you disengage, you turn a 10-year sentence into a 20-year, a 25-year sentence.
If you fling addiction into the mix.
Through disengagement. Well, that is, addiction's the ultimate disengagement for your hangy. When you disengage, it doesn't matter whether it's through addiction, through other forms of misconduct. You disengage, and I was like, can use or the people we trust to come in and help us. He's disengaged within 5 minutes. And so that was kind of my point there. And
that's quite a good wee...
It was a good way to disappoint that, right? So there was other things that we'd done, but that was one of them. Then I started going and meeting, Sarah started taking me to SPS engagement, stuff at universities and conferences.
Higher
and stuff.
Level stuff, kind of.
Aye, so I was sitting in a room with some of the politicians and me hanging. I was on day release for prison.
Right.
And then at the same time, though, I was also studying. Well, take it back a bit. When I was at Greenock through Sarah, I actually got to work at the Centre for Youth and Criminal Justice. That was my placement. Claire Lytle, it was a woman who arranged that, and she ran the centre at the time,
I'd done a placement in the CYCJ's.
Oh, did you? All right, so I never knew that. So that would have been after me, because I was the first one. So she turned up at Greenock Jail and just knocked on the door and was like, "I'm here to see John McGee, and like, I want to see him now," kind of thing. So they come and got me through my cell and took my way down. And there's this woman for the public who's come all the way through, no appointment, and being like, "I want to see him."
She's lovely.
She's so good. So genuine and so like wanting to help and so being like, I tried emailing, they didn't answer my email, so I turned up at their door. Do you know what I mean? I was like, "Oh, that's pretty direct." Fuck, she did. So she's done that, got me out there. I didn't really like the placement because there was a lot of sort of, I don't know what your experience was, you can tell me in a minute, but for the minute I went in, they tried to give me, Claire was away on, I think it was a honeymoon or something, or a baby had been born, she was maybe on...
Whatever it was, anyway, so
she's took me, she's been away, and this other woman, I'm not going to say her name, but she's took me, and as you go down and round the side, there's like two rooms, it's like opposite the windows, and she was like, "This has got to be your hanging room here," and I was like, "It's kind of like a cell, it's not even as big as a cell," I said that to her, I was like, "This is like a cell," I was like, "This is, like, why am I tucked away for everybody?" And it made me feel like, stick the jail guy round there until we can trust him, kind of thing. And she's like, "Oh, I don't know that. This is just where I thought to put you." She's like, "It's a spare desk." And I was like, "Right, no bother." So I've sat down and I'm like, right away, I'm like, "This is fucked." Do you know what I mean? So she's obviously went away and spoke to somebody, come away back round and being like, "Oh," because you know what it's like, it's, there's an open plan bit.
Right at the back,
as soon as you go at the lifts, you go round a bit, and then it's like, there's an open plan bit, then there's glass windows, glass doors rooms. Mm-hmm. I was round the corner for there a wee bit by myself. She's come away and got me, and she's been like, I didn't mean that. There's like, the desks are free, you could just go and sit there. So right away I'm thinking, why was that not the first place you thought to put me? But cool, fuck it, I'm happy for the opportunity anyway. But then there was all mad shit. Like, I wasn't
must
allowed.
Have grew on that then, John, because when I went in, it was like Debbie and it, and they were great.
Debbie was there, but she wasn't in charge of me. But I'm not got. So what I didn't want to say who was great and then leave out who the person who wasn't.
I didn't want to talk about.
And so was this person that I'm talking about. So like, apart from this. So anyway, I wasn't allowed to go downstairs to get food or that. A couple of times I kind of go, but this person, so she was like, at the very beginning, did you know what the sandwiches are like that they give for the jail? They're pure all mouldy and all shite, so I would never ever take them. And in fact, they were probably right to treat me like this. But so what? She used to take me, and she'd be like, "I'll get you like soup in a roll or something if you want, right?" And then one day I came in, and she pulled me into a room, and she was like, "Listen, I'm not buying your food anymore. I didn't get paid for it. I'm not allowed to take out of the petty cash." And I was like, I never asked you for any food. I'm shite myself because I think she's got to report me to the jail as if I've been exploiting her. And I was like, I never asked you for any of this. What have I done? How have I offended you to the point we're hanging? So basically she was like, you can either eat your sandwiches, she was like, or you can just sit there at your desk and sip your water like you usually do when you've not brought your sandwiches. And nowhere I got the sip in the warm water thing, it was like for like the hunger strikers and thing, that's what they used to do. When you're hungry, if you drink like warm water or tea or something, it makes your stomach kind of like, so I used to do that during the day if I hadn't had anything to eat, because you never had time for breakfast in the morning when you had a placement. So you just get out and you just go straight to your placement. So you'd wake up in the morning and no eat until you go back at like 6 o'clock. So I would do that to kind of stave off the hunger.
So do you think that?
So that kind of really negatively hanged my experience of being there, which was still, it was still good. There was a couple of things like that. So I went for there. I went up to Castle Huntly, and then I applied to go to university up there. So I was the first person to go for.
And that wasn't allowed, wasn't it? No, they told me no
like two or three times.
I remember that.
And then they went, if you can get a university to be interested in you, then you can, basically you can. And I wrote to Dundee University, and I was like, basically I want to come and study there, and Professor Cross, his name is at Dundee, he's like the professor of law there. He got back to me and he was like, "We'd love to have you, we didn't care that you're in prison. We would love to have you here." So I went for a meeting with him, and he was like, "Listen, I didn't care
it
what you've
such
done."
It makes a big difference, doesn't it? When you get that empathy and compassion, I think that's what's lacking in the prison system. I've always said it, that division. And as soon as somebody treats you the way they did in the CYCJ, it puts your mind frame straight back into fear. People don't understand the fear that you're, see when you're on these placements and stuff, the fear that you've got, that the power that people have got over your life is astronomical. I totally agree with you, John. So Professor Cross gets you in, and that changed, because that then changed, that opened up the...
Well, I never really. So basically what happened was, it changed for that time period. So I was the first person to go to the CYCG and to have a university placement, which they told me I couldn't have, and I had to write to the university begging for it, basically, and they come and they done it. And then that's how also Greenock got the reading groups, because I'd wrote to the university. That almost cost me 4 more additional months in prison as well, because there was a governor called Wally Stewart, and then there was a deputy governor called Colin Brodie, and they had some sort of weird shit where they were like shitting on each other's ideas and stuff. And because this was Colin Brodie trying to push this through, Wally Stewart was trying to throw obstacles in the way, and it was really weird. But I ended up getting to go. But then Colin Brodie one day, I was off ill. No, I had a home visit, so you get it was the only time my bairns could be there. So I took a home hangy on the day I was meant to be at the CYCJ, and that Colin Brodie was waiting on me coming in, and he gave my address and done in front of everybody. And I was just like, just take me off the placement. Like, I didn't know what to be there. If it's got to cost me more time in prison. So because it took so long to sort that, basically I was going to spend 4 more months in the top end, which would have affected my stuff at Castle Huntly. So anyway, there was loads of stuff inside the prison and outside the prison that really, really negatively affected. Then I went to Castle Huntly and they were like, oh, you're not getting to go into, you know, you didn't get to go to university, the papers will have a field day. But like, nobody cared. Like, I was getting out every day at university. There may be people watching this now going, oh, that guy was in my class, I never knew he was a fucking scumbag, you know what I mean? But that's what it is, it's done now, I got the degree. So I went there to study law, and I got the first degree, obviously, through the Open University that the SPS had tried to take away from me because I never had any hires. Got to go there, again against their wishes, and with them try to stop it. And then for there, obviously, almost as soon as I go, I think I go at 217, well, I know I go at 217. And then in 2019, I done a master's degree at Glasgow University, who incidentally they refused to have me there as a placement. They knocked Sarah Armstrong back, basically in case I went there and caused a scene and it affected their international stand-in, was I think how they put it. They weren't very supportive. They would take me after the fact. But what happened was they took James there afterwards, and then obviously the CYCJ took you.
So obviously, like, we can see that education's been a big part of your life, John. So can you tell us a wee bit about like your studies? I know you've done a lot of studies into a lot of different things.
So my first degree was in social policy and criminology. Then I done a second degree, like I was saying, when I was at Castle Huntly. I done a law degree. Then I done a master's of research degree at the University of Edinburgh, University of Glasgow, sorry. Now I'm at it's kind of between the University of Glasgow and the University of Edinburgh. I've got two supervisors. The PhD that I'm doing now, the doctor that I'm doing, is at the University of Glasgow, but the centre that works with the kind of data that I'm working with is at the University of Edinburgh. So my office that I share with somebody is in the University of Edinburgh, in the big old law. Have you been to the University of Edinburgh?
I think so.
It's a big old law thing. It looks like you walk through this big arch and it's like you go back in time. It's really, really cool. So I'm there doing a PhD, and basically what is, we're looking at building risk profiles of people who are misusing drugs, who have accessed help, and it's like tier three and tier four rehabilitation services in Scotland, which is in the community or residential, basically.
It's kind of most chaotic kind of ones, like say.
I don't know, because you didn't get to see that. So I don't know. For tier the four, data I get to see tier 3 and tier 4.
Tier 4,
so,
like,
so I think tier 3 would be if you've got a CPN, CPN in the community, maybe a drug worker or whatever, and tier 4 would be if you're a residential thingy. So, and then basically I've got access to that data and the immortality data.
Aye.
So we're looking at building risk profiles at people who are at tier 3 and who have accessed tier 3 and tier 4 rehabilitation services and who have had contact with the criminal justice system. So their original PhD, which is what I got funding for, what I was supposed to be doing, was looking at the mortality rates of people who have come out of prison in Scotland.
Aye.
And that was falling on for somebody called Leslie Graham, who done it like 20 years ago. I want to do a more updated version, but I want to bring in prison experience, so looking at people who have had loads of misconduct reports, who have failed drug tests, who didn't get much money handed in, so they've lost contact with their family, they didn't get many family visits, and I was hoping the SPS would be able to give me access to that.
So looking at
vulnerabilities, but based on how a person manages to operate the way through prison, because I didn't even know how many friends I've lost that have come out of prison. I remember counting, and I was in double figures of people who I was close to, and then you've got the people who you just hear about. I was in double figures of people who I've actually sat with and who were my friends, and then there's people who I was friendly with who have all died. So that was something that I feel quite passionate about, that I still want to do. Couldn't get the funding for my PhD was only 3 years, so I couldn't get access to the data in time. I'm hoping to do that as a postgrad. For my actual PhD, I got put onto someone else's project. And like I say, that's trying to build risk profiles of these people. And so that will be looking at people who have been in prison or who are still in prison, but also looking at people who are on drug treatment and testing orders, probation, who have had like community-based
DTOs and stuff like that, the community-based orders
and stuff. So a wide range of stuff we'll be looking at now and try to look at, are people more likely to die if they've got certain maybe health vulnerabilities? People have access help with their mental health or physical health or people. So I'm
what
looking
is
at
your
a
early
wild,
findings, John?
I can't tell you. So basically the type of... So I work within a thing that's called a data safe haven, right? And it's regulated through like various legislation, right? And I need to do all sorts of training to be able to operate there. And I need to pass, like you get tested, I think the testing's every 3 years or something, to be able to be a worker within the safe haven. And in order to even talk about any of the findings, even any of the data, even if I wanted to tell you what variables I'm allowed to look at, I would need to get
consent.
Clearance. Now you need to get clearance for the data controller, the person whose data it is, I'm sure it is, through a IDRIS, which is Public Health Scotland. So basically, I would need to do that before I can even say this or I know that. But like even that in itself, coming for a person who couldn't be trusted to. I don't know, they basically anything like that. So as a young offender, I was always in the Pullman and that, and I was always up to no good.
Aye.
I always had, like I mentioned, I always had mobile phones and that, the earlier stages of my prison sentence and stuff. If you go to not being able to be trusted to have like any kind of job inside prisons, to now being trusted to work within a safe haven,
it's a massive achievement, a massive turnaround. But what I'm interested in, John, is, and I know you probably can't answer this, right?
It's funny because I say that and you go, aye, that's great, but what am I actually interested in?
No, not at all. Listen, your journey's amazing. Honestly, it's an amazing journey. And you know how proud I am. I've always said that. Thank you, mate. But what I'm interested in is, what is the key? And I know it's...
Yeah, you've asked that about a few things, like what is the key? See, the thing is, I think it's very difficult to sort of pinpoint anything. So for me, it was education. Me being able to get educated and me being able to meet the people that I need to meet to get to where I need to be. But I've always been, because of like my previous life, if you want to put it like that, before I went to prison and the way I meet people and the way I'm able to sort of communicate with people and really network, like I'm quite good at networking. So because of that, I'm able to, do you know what I mean? I was able to sort of get to where I need to be, but there might not be that for somebody else. Like,
it's
for some
no
people,
one shoot, it's no one
aye, so some people find God. Aye. Some people find God and they really manage to make something of their life when they go. Mm-hmm. Like, look at Big Four. Like, you would never think 10 years ago that he would be the type of guy that would be going about helping folk. He's really turned his life around through that.
It's a coiny with the coiny. He's got the Paradise Recovery Cafe.
Coiny for Postle.
And these are guys who I would never have thought would have changed. Do you know what I mean? So you can never write MDR.
I think that's always been in them. But I don't think they've changed. I think Coiny could have always been doing that. He's just needed the, I don't know, he's just needed the sort of the realisation in himself. So I think he's still the old coin, eh? I think he'll still be the same guy when you go and try to have a laugh film or whatever. He'll still have the same banter, the same partner. His relationships with his family is the same relationships that he had. The way he talks might be a wee bit different. He might not be as aggressive. He might not be, do you know what I mean? And that's the same with me. All my relationships with all my family are the exact same.
Mm-hmm.
I've not changed. I'm still the same dad. I'm still the same brother. I'm still the same cousin, the same son. I'm the same guy, right? I'm the same friend. Do you think I'm, other than being a bit more bald, a bit more specky, do you know what I mean? Am I any different from the guy you met in NIC?
No, you're still as annoying.
But do you know what I mean? You're the same guy. And I just think, there's just wee things that change through maturity or whatever, but that's not you as a person. You as a person, you're the same person. Aye. Do you know what I mean? I feel, but I might be wrong.
Because it's such a big change, John. It's literally polar opposites what you've went through.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know that's not going to happen for everybody, but this is what we've been trying to do on some of the episodes is trying to find where the key is, and it's, I don't,
so the key, is, so to me the key, right, no, so like just thinking about what you've been saying there and thinking about what I've seen in prisons, right, so you've got Davy Martindale, right, who you've maybe even wanted to try and get on here as well, right, so you've got Davy Martindale, who's brilliant at football, always a brilliant sportsman. I used to see him playing tennis, he'd play anything, he's like Terry Scott from Abbott, any sport he turned his hand to, he was great. Went in the jail, I'm sure, I don't know if this was his trajectory, but this is how I remember it. He went in the jail for what he'd done, and he never changed. All he done was took the skills that he had done, like his SFA coaching badges and all that stuff in jail, which was it to offer. They found something that they could harness, which was his love for sport and his love for football and his love for teaching and his love for, do you know what I mean? They managed to find something that he was good at and go, we can do that with you, right?
I think it's individualising somebody.
One size fits all doesn't fit anybody for anything. What a one size fits all justice system, we've seen how that's turned out. If you try to have a one size fit all fits all education system, nobody gets educated because you're trying to do too many things for too many people that doesn't suit either their style of learning. When you look at a one size fits all justice system, how are they helping people by treating everybody the same? Everybody should have like an equal footing, but harnessing my education and my thirst for knowledge and for hanging and stuff like that, that's what it was for me. Imagine if in there, and I think they probably would have if he asked, but in shorts, if they were like that, oh Sean, like, you fancy trying to do podcasts, or if you knew that was something you could do, they've got a recording studio in shorts, like I've been in it doing stuff. That's something you could have done there. They could have harnessed that. That could have been a route for you out of prison. The people that find Roger in there, there's a wife for that, and they really harness that in there. There's a lot of positives that come out of being in prison, but I don't think it's prison that does that. Do you know what I mean? I think that's something that could happen in the community.
It's when that person comes to the realisation that they need to change, or they need to find something that takes them away from that life, because the vast majority, John, don't. The vast majority don't have the awareness or don't have the level of, I don't know if it's consciousness or something, but they just don't have. Once you go down that vortex of addiction and stuff like that, in prison, it's very hard to come back out of.
I agree with that. And some of the stuff I've seen with legal highs at the later part of my sentence, and I believe that they're a lot worse. So basically, again, like going back to like my own sort of route, I went into I ended up getting an internship with the SPS. Aye. So it was like working for the enemy. I was like, see that way where you're really conflicted and you're like, I got educated there, managed to like turn my life around a wee bit, but they're still the enemy. Like I've still got cousins in there, I've still got friends in there. I know they're getting treated like they're trying to get onto their placements, nobody's getting anywhere, and I'm like, but then you meet them and you just realise it's like people just try to do a job, just like you're trying to do a job. Not everybody can do everything. Do you know what I mean?
And it's a hard job, let's be honest.
And their funding's like been cut. Well, it's not been cut, it's been stagnated over 5 years or something. So obviously as the prison population goes up year after year, they can't help who they get sent. The courts need to stop sending people because I think they're at 8,000 now.
I know.
Do you know what I mean?
It's crazy.
And they've already showed during COVID what they can do, because when COVID hit, they were like, so all the people that didn't really need to be in jail, we'll just stop sending them. And I was like, they've got it down to 6,000 something. Do you know what I mean? Levels of imprisonment that they've not seen in fucking decades. Overnight they were able to go, you know what, all these people didn't actually need to be in jail. Do you know more than 50% of people that are on remand didn't go on to receive a custodial sentence? So right away, all the thousands of people you could already take out of remand. More than 50, I'm sure it is.
And there's guys on remand now that have been on remand for like
for a long time because of COVID, right? So that's the kind of thing they can't really help. So the SPS can't help who they get sent. They get sent whoever they get sent, and they need to find space for them. Do you know what I mean? But you could help that by the courts being like, do you know what? Like, there's a way we can deal with this.
The SPS, you've got you find gems within the SPS, but the vast majority is still that. I'll go on and on about it till I'm blue in the face. There's massive trust issues between cons and between staff, and there always will be. You get gems that try and try and nurture and try and fix that, but how do you fix
the screws in jail? Are just they're people like anybody else, right? So if they've been in there for 30 years, right, and in their 40 year in there through the all the riots, hostage taken, like, and that wasn't even fit. Like, I've been in halls where staff have been taken hostage.
I know.
Do you know what I mean? And you're like, so when all that goes on, and then you're like, That's traumatic. Do you know what I mean? That's the shit I've seen traumatic. So I've been diagnosed with PTSD. Do you know what I mean? I've been I'm waiting on a SpaceX. So we never even got the chance to go into like mental health and stuff after prison. How long have we even got left? 15. So we're not going to get the chance to even speak about that properly. But after prison, like, it wasn't we've been talking about this for the last hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes, as if my route was fucking flawless. When I got out of prison, I was struggling mentally. Like, I was back doing my bit, like hanging up, being around people that I really shouldn't have been. I'm doing a master's degree or studying law and stuff, like got to the pub with cunts and saying, like, do you know what I mean? Like, doing things that being around people that I'm like, at any minute I could go back to jail. And I think with my wee boy being born, and I started kind of being like, what the fuck am I playing at? But I was still struggling to sleep at night.
Do you think it's a safety thing, John, when you feel as if that's where you belong?
So that's one of the things. I've always had a sense that I didn't belong. So anywhere. So I didn't feel like I belonged as part of any group growing up. I was bullied quite a lot. I think that was quite a lot to do with how I ended up being really violent. And I think that was like, it became like a defence mechanism. And one of the things I'd say, like, I never ever done anything to somebody who wasn't either trying to date to me first or who I thought was a threat. So there was always some sort of, I was never one of these sort of, see, you get the guys that hang about with you when you're younger and they attack somebody in the street and you'd be like, what'd you do that for? I was never one of the types of guys, right? So I was always with the guy that you met in jail that if I thought there was a threat, I would go and address it. And I would address it swiftly before something happened to me. And I think that's how I survived. Like, I'm one of the guys that going to trouble in every jail I was in, come out with no extra, no additional scars, and everybody takes second prizes. I was in the hangy, do you know what I mean? But, like, I managed to get through that in one piece.
Aye.
Where not everybody, obviously, not everybody does.
So many people are
but I always felt like I didn't fit in. So any hall I went in, like, I didn't ever feel like, oh, this is my thingy, and then I go out. I didn't fit in universities. I didn't feel like you get put in like PGR groups, like your cohort for postgraduate researchers. Didn't fit in with any of them. My life experiences are different. And I didn't feel like I feel like I fit in with them, basically. And then at home, and I go, I didn't feel like I fit in with like the people from my area that I grew up in. I didn't fit in with them before, about away. I didn't. That's why it was easier for me, I think, to break away from them all and be like, hanging. So I didn't think it's a safety thing, to get back to your question. So I didn't think I fitted in with them in the first place. And when I go out, I didn't fit in with them, but it was all new. They were all new. So until I managed to start building a life for myself, with having like, other people for other walks of life that I could call friends. Like we started up our own group, Spark, Scottish Prisoners Advocacy and Research Collective, and that really helped me sort of break away from the thing. You would meet up regularly, and it was a whole different way of living. So when I was talking to like people for that group, and you'd learn about their life, and you'd be like, what? Do you know what I mean? That's how you're supposed to live. So, and meeting people where that undercurrent of poverty and the risky violence and the whatever, do you know what I mean? Like being able to like move your life forward.
People can't understand it.
People didn't understand things like I've spoke to people at universities, and that's like, my mum worked at the local primary school, and she used to steal like the Weetabix that were for the bairns and the milk, right? And we'd have Weetabix for like two or three meals of that day or what, I mean, for days. And we were living, I was rare that I lived with both my mum and my dad, so I didn't stay in a single parent household. And both of them worked full time, they always worked, all had jobs, and they were criminals on the side, they were always up to doing credit cards, there was always like other shit happening. And I still lived in poverty. Do you know what I mean? I was still that guy with the holy trainers who got to school. We didn't go to school at the end of the summer holidays until my mum got paid in September, so we could get new trainers and school clothes, and that would be my clothes for the whole year. We'd have like two outfits that would kind of rotate.
You're a product of the environment, aren't you?
So I was even rarer in the fact that how the fuck are you growing up in poverty when you stay with both parents, they've both got full time jobs, all right jobs, and they're doing credit card fraud every now and then and whatever. And in the later years growing up, there's like drugs being sold and there's like other shit going on and that. I'm still fucking got to school hungry. Do you know what I mean? How the fuck you got to school hungry when there's all this money coming in? Obviously, there's things like, there was addiction issues in my house, both alcohol and drugs. You didn't think the bingo was a gambling addiction, but my mum was at the bingo every single night. And the drugs was my mum, it wasn't even my dad. People assume, it must have been your dad, or it was my mum that was taking like loads and loads of prescription drugs, buying them on the black market or whatever. So
I just think that your story's amazing, John. I think it's such a unique... And I think that's hard. I think that's why it's hard for you to like even be somebody that can go, this is the key, or this is, because it's so unique. You've came from like an environment, you're a product of an environment where you've been violent and stuff like that for poverty, to actually going to the higher kind of entry lot of education, which is phenomenal.
That's what I mean, like teaching at university, like going and teaching at like the University of Glasgow, and then I've done like guest lecturing at like up in Abertay, up in Dundee. I've got work in an office at Edinburgh University. Do you know what I mean? Like how these spaces weren't open to people like us. I remember saying to Julie Thompson at Adewell, and she was like, oh, about doing a degree, and I was like, no, like I'm feel like here, there, I didn't know anybody about university. Never mind did a master's degree and then got to be a doctor. I'll be the first doctor that I know. I was the first person in my family maybe my cousin Ellen was, I don't know, but it was between the two of us, with an actual degree. Nobody went to university, nobody even went to college. Do you know what I mean? And that's growing up in that environment of poverty and stuff. You didn't aspire to that, because nobody done it before you. You aspire to be a drug dealer,
bricky, or
a brickie. Do you know what I mean? Get a trade or sell drugs. That's kind of your two options. Very few make it in sport, football. You got like Derek Riordan from Mabbott made it in football, but other than him, I didn't know anybody else who made it in sport.
and even good players. There was a few guys that were really good for Edinburgh. I know a couple of guys, goalkeepers and stuff like that, who played for Scotland and stuff. And they, because of the poverty they were in, they get stuck in that life, do you know what I mean? And they're like good boys that are just stuck in. And it's trying to explain to people where we need to bring so much more lived experience and
you do. So see, at the later end, you need lived experience, but see, at the start, all the funding for all the, see all these wee guys that are into sport that are good at boxing, like Big Fundo, who just died like a month or two ago, right? Guys like him who are great, good at boxing, guys that are good at football, like you're saying, there's other sports that guys are, I don't know, I'm not a sports person, but I'm assuming that you've got to get people that are good at everything. You've got guys that are good at music, you've got guys that are good at fucking, like guys like myself, guys that are good at education, guys
show them how to
fix cars and stuff, so you've got all that they can be harnessed in the community before they even get to the stage that they're at prison. That's what Face North are doing. I forget that their new hanging name, but that's what they did, right? Look them up and I'll speak to them only by him. I'll actually phone them when we're in the car going back, right? But you've got things like that, and if you make sure the funding isn't going to all these creating jobs for middle class wankers, right, who are coming in straight out of uni, getting these jobs to run these youth clubs and that, they're not doing it. And if they are, they've not got the lived experience to go, do you know what, that's hanging.
The wee guys don't listen to
the boys that run Face North are fair bit. Do you know what I mean? They're fair of a scheme, and they know who all the people are, and they can turn up at your door and they'll know your mum and dad, and they'll be like, we need to take him because he's causing fucking havoc, we want to stop him from getting the jail. That's something that can be replicated everywhere if the funding's right and you get the people right, the people who are sitting around the table right. And that can include the police, that can include local social work. If it's a mutual benefit of the community, if it's not seen like the police are, they deal operationally, so it's like they'll be like, oh, like this month we're like, get all the wee guys off the motorbike, we've not got time to help you run your thing. They need to come away for their way of thinking, but we need to come away for our way of thinking. Do you know what I mean?
A million percent.
We've got all these skills in our community, we can harness that.
Society needs to heal, and it's a working class. I've said it before. I don't know how you'd have done it. It's an ingenious way. Like we've got the Tories in power there. I don't know how they're there. There's so much merry as working class, but we've got the Tories in power, and then we've got working class policemen, working class prison officers, working class prisoners.
The poor locking up the poor, eh?
We're all locking up each other, and we're fighting against each other. Instead of, like as you say, finding out what we can. There's so much we can do. I mean, there's so much.
Nah, definitely. So that's kind of. That's the kind of stuff I want to be doing, and no director. I didn't want to be walking up the streets talking to you guys, because who the fuck am I to tell them? My experience was 20 years ago, I'm 40. My experience was 20, 25 years ago. How I experienced that community is now, how that community is now, right?
Yeah, I know.
So I don't know how you would also navigate the difficulties, but I want to be more of a, like, sort of supportive role, helping people set that sort of stuff up while I'm still doing my own academic stuff. Like, I don't know how to go about it. I've helped with wee bits and pieces, but
just keep doing what you're doing, John. I mean, what you're doing is amazing, and your story's an amazing story. It's a inspiring story. And it is a story that, like, shows the resilience and shows the kind of when you've got that bravery to go through, and now you're out talking as a nearly going to be at that next time you're on here, you'll be Dr. McGee, hopefully.
That is, Matt. Well, my thesis is to be in by March next year, so and I'll be finished it by then. So
you'll be back on we'll get you back on when you're Dr. McGee, and you can let us know about the updates. But just kind of bringing it, we're obviously coming to an end, John, man, and it's been a brilliant look talking to you in the podcast. It's been brilliant content. But just in your last kind of,
you're one of the podcast wankers now, eh? Like, brilliant content in that. Like, you've changed. Never mind, I've changed. You've changed.
But if you can just, like, if there was a wee message for, like, anybody, like, any of the young team prisoner, anybody that's kind of struggling out there, or anybody that's going through what we went through, what kind of message would you just give them, just to kind of, I know it's a kind of hard question to say, but a wee message just that you could give them to show that there is another world, there is another.
Just if I can do it, anybody can. Like, if you've took one thing away from if you've managed to listen to this whole podcast, if you took one thing away from it, is just know that my life was pretty hopeless in the beginning. I was always going to end up a guy who spent his whole life in and out of jail. For me, it was education. Doesn't have to be education, but there's like there is basically steps you can take yourself by just being persistent.
Right.
I was told no a million times for the SPS about doing a degree, about going to uni, about having a university placement, about having reading groups, about fucking anything. It was like, no, like this is it's a one be there one size fits all thing here, and you can't do that.
Right.
I'm proof that they didn't. I'm proof that if you keep annoying them enough, keep putting in writing, just keep doing whatever it is you need to do, basically. That's not a short message. That's a big long-ass message, mate. Sorry, but
that's
what it is. Be persistent and just know that if I can do it, anybody can do it.
Brilliant, John. And hopefully we'll get you back on when your doctorate's up. And I just want to thank you for coming on the show. It's brilliant seeing you. Always great to see you.
Thanks for having us, mate.
Brilliant.